Davison, who's our moderator today.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for coming today. I am so excited. I pride myself on being a really tough moderator who doesn't kiss butt, but I'm going to kiss some serious butt today. This is for really, really great people to talk to, and I was so excited when I was invited. But I am going to try. I've promised them to try and be tough to keep us on time because I want us to get through a lot of stuff today, a lot of substance, and get to some conversations about it. So I'm going to force myself to be rude sometimes to people I admire so much. So the basic format is I'm going to ask each person to present what they would do if they had a chance to sit down with whoever is our president in January for 5 minutes to kind of lay out what's going on in the U.S. economy and what are the key things you could focus on. But Michael Porter here is going to lead us off with sort of a framing, and I'd imagine I don't need to give him too much introduction. Michael Porter has really defined how economists and practitioners in economic development think about this whole question of competition between countries, between regions, between companies. His book On Competition is the Bible. I mean, it's the, well, I shouldn't say things like that here, probably. It's a very helpful book. and it is inerrant. I could go on and on. He's at the Harvard Business School, the Institute for the Study of Competitiveness, which I find is just a remarkably helpful source for data. He assures me there's a book he's working on now that's exactly on the topic we're talking about today, which I think your notes are all about that book. But he doesn't have that book now, but he on competition and dozens of other really, really important papers and books. So, Michael, you know, we've heard a lot of words. I don't know that we've heard a lot of substance from the presidential candidates about this moment in U.S. economic history. We've heard about China and this uneasy sense. Are they a friend? Are they a foe? We've heard about, we haven't really heard that much, to be honest with you, of any substance, just a lot of nonsensical words. So if you sat down with the president and he said, all right, I had to get elected, so I said what I said. But what do I actually need to think about? How is America doing right now in the world?
Well, Adam, thank you so much. And we all are privileged to be with you. So you're much too kind. So it's a beautiful day out there, and I hate to have to talk about this subject on such a beautiful day. Because it's not a beautiful day in the American economy. I have been leading a project that Harvard Business School undertook about a year and a half ago about really trying to understand what was going on in the economy. Because we started about a decade ago to see some things that were very disturbing in terms of our fundamental trajectory and in terms of the prosperity that our economy was generating for all of us as citizens. You know, what are some of the key indicators that concerned us? Job generation. Job generation has come to a screeching halt in historical terms. It started well before the actual recession of 2007 and 2008. And what's most disturbing is that pretty much all the jobs we've been creating for the last roughly 20 years have been in the local part of our economy, healthcare, government, real estate, not in the traded part of our economy, the part that's exposed to international competition. So something profoundly different is going on in terms of job generation. Wages, we all know, have stagnated or even declined in real terms. And there are many, many other metrics. Something is going on. It's not just a recession. It's not just a downturn. It's not President Obama. It's something much more fundamental. And it has to do, we fundamentally believe, with this whole issue of the inability of our middle and lower skilled workers in America to actually sustain a middle class wage in a world where there are billions of other people with a good high school education as well. And as other countries have been improving their circumstances in terms of their efficiency, their road system, their regulation, their corruption policies, and so forth. We set out to study this issue in some depth, and we have been on this journey now for about, again, as I said, about 18 months. Fortunately, we believe the U.S. retains some critical strengths, but we have many challenges that we have to overcome. I think very important for this discussion today is to be clear on what we mean by competitiveness. Competitiveness occurs, based on our thinking, when two things happen. One, where companies operating here can actually compete successfully in international markets. That's part of competitiveness. The other part of competitiveness, though, is that as they do that, the wages and standard of living for the average American has to be able to go up. We can't have companies succeeding and workers not succeeding. We can't have workers succeeding and companies not succeeding. We have to do those things together. And in order to do that, the only way we can do that is to become a very, very productive place to do business. We have to have the right environment. We have to have low cost of doing business. We have to have an efficient infrastructure. We have to have people with skill. And if we're not productive, we simply can no longer sustain the wages that we have today. Now, fortunately, we are a very productive economy historically. We have a lot of strengths in innovation, entrepreneurship, university systems, technology. We have a lot of strengths, but we've allowed weaknesses to crop up. Very rising cost of doing business, regulatory complexity, legal complexity, and we've let our fiscal future become dire in terms of our budget situation, and that's forcing us to squeeze our investment in a lot of other things that we need to kind of drive productivity in the economy. So we can talk a little bit later, and I'm sure everybody has ideas about what to do, but I don't think of this as a cyclical problem. This is a structural problem. It's been building for many years. It's much worse than the Japan challenge. Japan was one country. It was a relatively high-wage country, a high-cost country. Now we're competing with dozens and dozens of other countries. They're getting better at a very rapid rate. They're improving their environment, their efficiency, their cost of doing business. And we are you know, participating in a circus in Washington, not getting anything done. So I think as we go forward today, let's talk about what we have to get done in Washington. We can do things in business. One of the major focuses of our project at HBS is to get the business community doing things that it can do itself without the need for federal policy. But ultimately, I'm sure we'll talk a lot about the role of government here going forward. Thank you, Adam.
Great. Thank you so much. And we're going to now go to Andy McAfee. Andy really came to my attention in the last year. He sort of, for me, exploded with this book that he wrote with, he's the one whose last name can be pronounced. Yeah, it's Eric.
I'm the non-Icelandic author.
Right. Eric Rishafrafer.
Brynjolfsson is my co-author.
Okay. Race Against the Machine. And this just became, it just hurtled onto the national debate about the future of the U.S. economy. And he's been working in this area, though, for a long time at MIT and also as a consultant to some of the, you know, coolest digital companies in the world. His focus at MIT and in this book is on this new digital future, which we hear talked about in sort of utopian ways, but you talk a lot about the real business, the real opportunities, and I think your book offers incredible optimism and also, echoing Michael, some real terror. So what do you do with your 5 minutes with Mr. Obamney when he steps into office?
So I would encourage Obamney to do two things right away. The first is to go out to Silicon Valley and sweet talk Google into letting you hop in the back of their autonomous car and drive around. It's an opportunity that I've had. The fact that I'm sitting here means that the car works at least pretty well. And I'm here to tell you it actually works like a champ. I drove down US 101 in Northern California with a car that had no driver. This is literally the stuff of science fiction. And one of my hobbies now is when I watch sci-fi to note the fact that all the vehicles are still driven by people. That's not what's going to happen. In relatively short order, we're going to get out of the business. The other thing that I'd encourage Obamney to do is try to play Jeopardy against Watson, the IBM supercomputer that was tailored to play the game of Jeopardy. I've had that opportunity too. It's incredibly humbling. And you realize that this thing is really good at playing this weird game of Jeopardy where the questions are designed to obfuscate what's really going on. There is puns, there is wordplay involved. They can ask you about basically any domain of human knowledge. And Watson trounced the two best human Jeopardy players in February of 2011. So after Obamney has these two experiences, I think he would take away two really important conclusions. The first one, Adam, like you said, is grounds for some serious optimism. We are living in a time of absolutely astonishing and unprecedented technological progress. Just in the past few years, computers have started doing things, I mean this seriously, we never thought they'd be able to do, like drive cars in traffic, fly planes, translate with decent quality among human languages, understand human speech, respond in human speech, do it in real time with very high accuracy levels. This is sci-fi. Until now, it's business reality. The second conclusion that you draw fairly quickly, though, is as technology races ahead, it is going to leave some people behind. And I think it has the potential to leave a lot of people behind. Mike has been really articulate about one of the tectonic forces shaping our economy these days, which is globalization. And I love your phrasing that there are suddenly billions of people around the world who are getting better very quickly. I think globalization is a way station on the way to automation because there are computers around the world that are getting better at a Moore's Law clip, doubling in their power about every 18 months. That's not going to stop. It's going to encroach more and more deeply into what we human beings can offer the labor force. So the what's left over for us to do, I believe, is shrinking. I believe it's shrinking pretty rapidly. And I think it is going that trend is going to accelerate instead of decelerate. So we're going to have some interesting labor force challenges. The third thing that I've taken away from the work that I've done, though, is there are certainly headwinds confronting the U.S. economy. I would still really rather be us than just about any place else on the planet. The historical pattern is pretty clear. When there is a huge technological shift, and I think we've seen two of them so far, the first Industrial Revolution and then the second one, which happened between about 1870 and 1900, when there is electricity, utilities, and the internal combustion engine. It's pretty clear that the economy that is at the forefront of developing those technologies is the one that takes the lead and holds the lead for a while. So it was initially Great Britain with the second Industrial Revolution, the torch passed to the United States. As I look around, the best news that I see for our economy is that America is still at the forefront of this astonishing technical progress that we're living through.
Fabulous. So, the optimism, now we turn to Esther for a deep dive into the pessimism, unfortunately, I think. Esther Duflo has been a very important, well, all of these people have, and has been very important in my understanding and lots of people's understanding of global poverty. And I realize I didn't introduce myself. I'm co-founder and co-host of NPR's Planet Money, which is sort of an economic explanation team, and I write in economics column for the New York Times Magazine. And annoyingly, we journalists tend to talk about the global poor as if the entire range of thought is on Manhattan between Bill Easterly at NYU, who says foreign aid doesn't work, leave it alone, the poor are on their own, and Jeff Sachs at Columbia, who says, no, there is a way to save them, do everything Jeff Sachs tells you, and everyone will be fine. And these are kind of the extreme poles of the debate and sort of boring, and not much new has been said in that space, I would say, in years. But all this time, Esther Duflo and many others have been working at the Jamal Abdul Latif Poverty Action Lab at MIT, and then a group of related scholars at Harvard who, Boston is really, or Cambridge has really been the center of this kind of work, of actually taking this kind of weird idea of let's actually find out what happens when we help poor people and do, like doctors do, randomized controlled trials of different interventions. It's very easy to sit around academic offices in the U.S. and say, oh, you need to charge people for vaccines or they won't take them, or you need to give bed nets for free, or whatever. But what Esther and her team does is actually go out and study it. Do randomized trials where they try one thing and have a control, and they've actually learned things. But I realized, thinking about today's panel, that because of her wonderful book, Poor Economics, I know actually an awful lot more about how we might intervene in the lives of the poor in India and Africa than I do about the poor in America. Mm. And the picture that Michael and Andy painted of large numbers, I mean, I counted in the tens of millions, maybe more, of Americans who really have no realistic hope of being a big part of this growing economy. What do we do for them? What do you tell Mr. Obomny, here's how to help America's poor?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure that they'd have 5 minutes for me. When you look at all the debates in the election, there has been no mention of the poor. There's almost no mention of inequality, except to the extent that they have this diverging opinion maybe about what should be done about the very rich. But then all is about the middle class, and everybody loves the middle class, and I love the middle class too. But there is no mention of poverty. Maybe, again, this is something you need to do in order to get elected. And I think if that's the case, that reflects the fact that the poor in the U.S., and maybe that's a bit different from the poor elsewhere in the world, the poor in the U.S. not only live in very difficult material conditions, but they are almost entirely excluded of any political and social process that is going on. They are not working. They go to schools where there is very little hope of getting anything out of the schools. They are rarely voting, or if they vote, no one cares who they vote for, and no one really tailors any of the discourse to them. And we don't really know or have paid much attention about how to improve their lives, which is really a shame. It is true that there are challenges, and it's true that the middle class might be struggling, and it is true that there are great opportunities, but how can a country let millions of people live on the margin of society with very little hope of getting anywhere? The big difference between the US poor and India's poor, which are the two places where I meet most poor people, is that the poor in the US, the real poor, I'm talking about the real poor in the US, are in a situation where not only they're poor, but they are repeated day in, day out, that it's their fault, and they have nowhere to go from there. And the fact is, it is not their fault. The fact is, it is linked to the fact that we have invested very little money, but more importantly, very little brain cells in trying to understand why people are poor and stay poor in a country with so much wealth around. There is very little effort to try to understand what policies are effective and what are not, to try to understand why people stay outside, to try to understand why people who are eligible for food stamps don't take them up. And more importantly, to try to understand how you would redesign, for example, the food stamp program to make it more inclusive. The food stamp example is good because it shows that there's one thing that the Obama administration did, which is to say, if a child qualifies for free lunch, they'll be automatically signed up for free lunch unless they decide to sign up. That change had the consequences that the number of kids on food stamp and free lunch went up tremendously. Of course, not necessarily a great political move, because you can think, oh, under Obama, so many people went on food stamp and free lunch. That's because they got signed up finally. This is a very small change. It's not rocket science. It is based on an infrastructure of really thinking about procrastination, about the fact that when you're poor, there are so many things you need to care about, that the signing up the kids for food stamps is maybe not the first thing you would think about, and then just doing it. And it's something that can be done under the radar screen with not so many political fights about budgets and things like that. Who would object to the fact that people should be signed up for the program for which they are eligible? That's a very small example of things that can be done in the current, in any political settings. If you really want to try to spend 5 minutes on the problem, try to spend 5 minutes on designing policies for the poor that are going to work better in order to achieve the goals of getting more inclusion, more hope, and more success.
That's very powerful, and no, they don't want to spend 5 minutes on it, I think is unfortunately the answer. So, Jeffrey, we're going to shift the conversation a little bit to... I first learned about you, Jeffrey, with your first trade book, Global Capital, the Fall and Rise of
Global Capitalism, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century.
That's it, yes. Yeah.
Memorable to some, anyway.
Yeah, no, Global Capitalism. All right. I got most of the words, but the order escaped me. But which was just a really... It's my dream book because it incorporates history with really smart economics in a readable, enjoyable narrative sense. And you've sort of your new book, The Lost Decades, is which you wrote with Menzi Chin, who's a great economics blogger from the University of Wisconsin. Deals really more with the short-term process. And we heard Michael talking about the cyclical problem, which is economic speak for, you know, a business cycle problem that, you know, a recession or even a depression that will go away sort of on its own in a sense. I mean, it's not a long-term, and a structural problem, meaning the country has changed in fundamental ways. It's not going back to the way it was. And your book is very much about the cyclical nature and how the non-structural problems in the economy. So lay out what you would tell the president. We're still, yesterday's announcement of 2% GDP growth, which is absolutely depressing this far into a recovery. What's wrong with our economy in the short term, and what can be done?
Right. Well, Mr. President, whoever you are, I don't have to tell you that the principal concern is the sluggishness of the economic recovery. This doesn't feel like the recovery from a typical cyclical recession. No matter how you look at it, employment, income, or output growth, we're between 3 and 5 years behind where we would be in a normal cyclical recession. So it doesn't feel like the recovery from a normal recession, and I would submit that that's because it's not. This has been not a typical recession, but a debt crisis such as we might think of in a country like Brazil or Thailand or Turkey or Russia or Mexico, where a country borrows enormous amounts of money from the rest of the world, typically doesn't use it very wisely, gets itself into trouble, and then has to recover. And that's what we did. Between 2001 and 2007, Americans borrowed between $500 billion and $1 trillion a year from the rest of the world. Some of that went to finance a budget deficit, federal budget deficit, that really was not justifiable on economic grounds. Much of it went to consumer credit, whether in credit card debt or consumer debt or especially housing debt. So we had a debt finance consumption boom, which led to a bubble, which has now burst. So we're in a debt crisis, not a typical recession, in the aftermath of one. And we know something about debt crises, partly in thanks to Carmen Reinhart, who couldn't be with us today, and her co-author Ken Rogoff. Debt crises are different. They're different economically, and they're different politically. They're different economically because the aftermath of a debt crisis leaves the society with a burden of accumulated debt that hangs on economic recovery. This debt overhang, as it's usually called, makes it difficult for both creditors and debtors to resume normal economic activity. Creditors find themselves with trillions of dollars, in the case of the U.S. and Western Europe, in debts, some of which they know to be bad and some of which they fear may be bad. And in these circumstances, they are not interested in making new risky loans. They're shedding loans. So banks aren't lending. But from the standpoint of debtors, they still hold these accumulated debts, and they've got to service them or else lose their homes or lose their cars. Meanwhile, they've had terrible shocks to their income, to their employment, to their assets, to the value of their home. So banks aren't lending, and consumers aren't spending. So economically, a debt crisis leads to a much more difficult recovery. But there's also the political side. Debt crises are different politically as well. Every debt crisis we know about ends up in mass political conflict. And that's for a very simple reason, because the political system is presented with the problem of figuring out who's going to pay the price to deal with this accumulated debt burden. Who's going to bear the burden of adjustment? Is it going to be the debtors? Is it going to be the financial institutions? Is it going to be government employees or taxpayers? We see it very clearly in an international basis in Europe, where it's Greeks against Germans or Finns against Portuguese or Belgians against Spaniards. In the U.S., it's more on the basis of, are you a saver? Are you an investor? Are you a financial institution? Are you about to lose your home? But every debt crisis leads to political polarization. It has done so in Europe. It has done so in the U.S., and unfortunately, that political polarization typically leads to political gridlock, which, of course, exacerbates the underlying economic effects of the crisis. So, as you step into or return to office, your problem is to deal with the accumulated burden of 10 years of debt of borrowing and the problems that rise out of that. In an environment in which the political system is so divided as to lead to near gridlock, which makes it difficult to move forward. Good luck.
Great. So, Jeff, is there a contradiction? Do you disagree with the rest of the panelists, or are you just talking about a different time frame? In other words, is it all just a debt problem, and then we'll go back to everyone being middle class, or are there these structural issues?
I think that I would agree with virtually everything I've heard. I think I think Esther's point on poverty and inequality is absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. That one of the reasons, and we may ask, why did the U.S. engage in this orgy of borrowing? Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons, I believe, is that one way that a government that didn't want to engage in direct redistribution could deal with the social problems that emerge is by encouraging borrowing by those who did not perhaps have easier access. The way it was expressed by one of my colleagues was, Americans think, who needs a social welfare state when everybody's got a credit card? Right. So the poverty issue, I think, lurks behind a lot of this, and of course it lurks behind the politics. The long term, I'll leave to Andrew, but I think there are a lot of important things there. I think where Michael and I, our different perspectives are on the micro and the macro. I don't think there's any question that a lot of what's happened the last 10 or 20 years has to do with our shifting emphasis away from productive activities that will increase our ability to produce trades and services for the international economy on the one hand, and more focus on current consumption. I think part of that is due to macroeconomic policy, but part of that is also due to the kind of microeconomic incentives that he's talked about.
So, Michael and Andy, I'd like your thoughts on this too. Sorry to use this language, but I talk about in my office the kind of line that separates the screwed from the not screwed, the people who have a path to the middle class and the people who don't. My family is from Worcester, Massachusetts, and I have a long line of people who either didn't finish high school or only finished high school and were able to afford a house, a car, etc. And I noticed that the people of my generation, that's not possible anymore. It's the people who have a college degree. What is the line? Is it a high school degree? Is it a college degree? Is there a different line between people who can take advantage of the promises of the future of the economy and people who really are locked out of those?
Well, there's so many things to talk about, but let me start. If you look at the recession that we've been sort of through, as we've discussed, four out of the five jobs that were lost were high school or less. Four out of the five jobs that were lost. Of the one out of five that wasn't high school or less, many of those have come back. Of the four out of five, very few of them have come back. So basically, it's you got to go beyond high school. You don't have to be a college graduate, but you got to have a skill in terms of operating machine tools, or you've got to have some significant skill that requires some training and education beyond a high school. That seems to be the critical line. But before we go any further, the most important thing the next president has to do is reach a compromise on our budget. That is the most important thing by far. We've surveyed HBS alumni. We've surveyed the general public. We all agree. If President Obama would have managed to sign Simpson-Bowles, this country would be in a fundamentally different place today. That is his greatest missed opportunity. We have to reach a compromise. It's going to take revenue. It's going to take spending cuts. It's going to take reprioritizing. We're going to have to be more efficient and more effective about everything we do in government to fight poverty and everything else that we want to do. But that is the single biggest thing we have to do. I think we all have to understand that. Now, there's a lot of other more micro things that we have to do as well. And critical, one of the critical ones, of course, is this whole skill agenda. Because without the skill agenda, it starts with public school, and I think we're starting to reach some headway there. There, President Obama gets a lot of credit. There's been a real effort to start to really make an impact on public education, deal with low-income families in poverty, get success in minorities and low-income communities. We're starting to see that in New York City, in New Orleans, in other places around the country at large scale. So we got to work on the skill thing, but there's a variety of other problems. And what you have to learn to understand is that when it's inefficient to do business in the United States, when healthcare costs are too high, when any costs are too high, regulatory costs, whatever they are, when any cost is too high, that comes out of the worker's salary. It doesn't come out of corporate profits because companies will just move activities overseas to avoid those costs. So the higher cost of doing business in the United States just lower the wages of people that don't have sophisticated skill. And so we can't think that regulatory reform is a political issue. It's about the wages of middle and lower middle class Americans. We can't think that we can no longer have this kind of divisive view that this is about, you know, redistribution or anything like that. This is a time in American economic history that we have not seen in decades, many, many decades. And the future is coming at us with a freight train. We are the leading innovation economy in the world still. Thank goodness for that. But the question is, how many of our citizens will be able to participate? And how do we get enough stability in our budget so that we can start investing again in the things that will enable that? And frankly, how can we get the business community to start playing a fundamental role? The business community can do more on skill training than government. And so we have a national campaign to try to stimulate that. But I think we all have to understand this is a moment that we have to move to agreement. There's no honor anymore in having debates. We have to move to agreement.
And to echo, Michael, what you were just saying about the role of the business community, I found it astonishing that just this week, what was about 80 very large company CEOs got together, and they kind of pleaded, and these guys were not all raving socialists, I assure you. They all kind of pleaded to the government to address exactly the problem that you described about our deficits, and they said, look, raise our taxes, essentially. This is silly. We know this needs to be part of a solution. We're willing to be part of that. So I'm encouraged that the business community is kind of, in a sense, coming together and reacting to this crisis that we're facing. Adam, I think your question is a great one about where's the cutoff line. My colleague at MIT, David Autor, is an economist who's done, I think, the most careful work to understand the economic fates of people at different levels of education. And his data so far show that your wealth line keeps increasing over time as you have a college education. Anything below that, you tend to be losing ground. So that's a problem for a number of reasons, maybe foremost because college in this country is still very, very expensive. When I look into the future, though, and I look at what digital technologies are able to do, I get a lot less sanguine about the value of a good old-fashioned college education. The unemployment rates of recent college grads are pretty dire, and when I look at what computers are able to do, they are honestly diagnosing disease and making medical calls with weird levels of accuracy. They can certainly answer a phone call and provide information on the level of an average customer service rep heading to a good customer service rep. A flip way to think about it is take Siri and hook it up to Watson and wait a while. Because if these technologies improve along a Moore's Law trajectory, and there's no reason to think that they won't, in 6 years, they're going to be 16 times better than they are right now. To think that's not going to eat into the labor force and encroach on what people can offer the labor force is just incredibly naive.
So, Esther, Michael presented this idea that we need to just, and Simpson Bowles, this is one of the two major proposals for sort of a grand compromise, a moderate Democrat, moderate Republican. We'll raise some taxes, we'll cut some social spending and some defense, and we'll get on a long-term budget, healthier budget trajectory. But others argue, well, this is exactly the wrong time to do that for the monetary reasons, and then also that if the fundamental problem is that there's millions of Americans who are locked out, does this just further doom them? Is that a concern for a grand bargain?
So I think this is getting a bit far afield my competencies, so you take that with a lot of caveat, but I don't think there is consensus on whether you need to borrow your way out of these things, or you can, or you could do it in a budget neutral way. I think what is important is to spend the money and the effort to do what needs to be done on the infrastructure front, on the education front, on the social service front, to not have a huge fraction of black people in prisons and various things like that. Where the money is going to come from, at some point or another, it will have to come from the pocket of people who have the money. So it's now or it's later, but at some point, if we are willing to make an effort on, you call it redistributing or you call it investing one way or the other, but on the least fortunate in society, we'll have to raise the money from somewhere. But I think it would make sense to raise it now as opposed to raise it after we have to pay the interest for it. But that's, I think, one could argue about that. But at some point, taxes will have to go up. And there it becomes a political choice to know where taxes need to go up. It could be that they should go up in a proportional way because you have a very strong view that that people would stop working if the marginal rates were very high at a very high at very high, or it could be that we think the taxes need to come up at the top because maybe the people who are at the top already work hard enough that they are not going to be discouraged by a slightly higher taxes. That's that I think that's a matter of taste.
But you made an important point a while back when you talked about the reasons why we seem unwilling to invest in this is that there's this idea in America that if you're poor, it's your fault. And I had this interesting experience a while back. I was at a roundtable at the Aspen Institute talking about technology, and my colleague, Eric, my co-author Eric and I were making the point that inequality is big and growing. People said, yeah, we get that. The middle class is stagnating. People said, yeah, we get that. And we said, and social mobility in this country is getting lower over time and is behind a lot of these, you know, social democrat Northern European countries that we love to mock for having too big a safety net. Everyone else in the room was astonished by that fact. The awareness that social mobility in this country is actually lower than it is in places like Germany and Denmark, that really has not seeped in very much. We still have this Horatio Alger idea that anyone can and should be able to rise up in the economy. The data are just saying the opposite.
Michael, here's what I'm confused, and I don't know if it's that you and Andy see the world a little differently. Is the fundamental problem, here's how I understand it, I could be wrong, that what you're saying is there are fundamental problems at every level of business, and even the 1%, even the very successful, are not seeing America as a place where they can get, where they can, for the long term, guarantee innovation and technology and growth. And so our fundamental problem is getting, keeping, holding, growing, nurturing the top businesses. Mm-hmm. And what I feel like I'm hearing from Andy is, no, we're great on that stuff. We're going to kick everyone else's butt, but it's not the benefits are not going to be shared with everyone in America. And then we obviously...
Let me talk about that. I mean, I think the Apple is the great metaphor. Apple doesn't make anything in the United States.
Yep.
Zero. And that's because the U.S. is not competitive as a location for them to make things at prevailing wages. And so they outsource, and they're not being evil, they're just being rational. They don't want to charge us any more than they need to for these overly expensive products that they sell us, and so therefore there's no reason to have to charge more because they cost more to manufacture. So they're putting stuff in locations where they can get perfectly good workers at a lower cost. Now, we can get mad at them and say that they're un-American, but the problem is we got to figure out the root cause is the capacity of the U.S. economy to be a very productive place to do business. Otherwise, what happens is we invent stuff. The really smart people, you know, that we have in our economy have marvelous higher education, we have marvelous top 25% skill levels. That goes well, and then the benefits don't flow to a broader set of people that have perhaps less unique skill capability. And that's the fundamental problem. Now, there are a lot of jobs in the economy that are not jobs that will be disintermediated. There's a lot of service and there's a lot of creative work and a lot of other things going on that are not necessarily going to be disintermediated by computers. But the cold hard truth is that unless you can, you know, have call centers here, and unless you can have things that employ people with middle levels of skill, then the innovation machine that we remain will not be nearly so effective in driving the whole economy forward. Higher income people are doing basically pretty well, but you know the famous Buffett rule, you know, tax everybody at least 30% raises a trivial amount of money in the scope of our budget problem. Trivial, it's nothing. We have to share that tax revenue burden across a lot more people than just the, quote, rich. So there's no quick fix here. But I keep believing that the root cause of a lot of this stuff is our inability to keep improving our infrastructure, to make our business environment. I work with all kinds of countries around the world, and they have whole working groups, and they get up every day to try to figure out how to be more efficient as a location for business. Every day. And we have a joke, you know, in our government, in terms of this set of issues. And we just can't get anything done. We can't agree on, you know, that the earth is round. You know, we can't agree on anything. And we've allowed that. That's all, you know. Yeah. Those are our representatives. And we can fix this stuff. I'm convinced of that. But it's not the rocket science part we're actually good at.
That.
It's the simple stuff that we can't do.
Can I make that concrete? Because I completely agree. I was talking a while back with the CEO of Siemens USA, who makes, you know, little locomotives and wind turbines and these huge pieces of incredibly complicated gear. And he says, for a lot of reasons, I want to make these things in the United States. It saves me transportation costs. I want to make stuff here. He says, I have two big problems, one of which is really lousy infrastructure. I've got to put these things on a rail car and send them across the country. He said, the American Society of Civil Engineers gives us, I think, somewhere between a C- and a D overall on our infrastructure. It's a travesty. He said, look, I can address that problem. I will invest in the rail spur to bring the railroad to my factory to put these things on it and leave. The second problem is an even bigger problem, and exactly to Michael's point, it's the skills problem. He said, my factories these days, huge, much bigger than this room, they take not thousands of people, like would have been the case a generation ago, they take hundreds of people to operate a factory that spans football fields worth of space. He said, my problem is I can't find the people to staff that factory. And I said, I'm sorry, there's a 9% unemployment rate. He said, I understand that. The skills you need to be a factory floor laborer in today's world are so different, and we're doing such a lousy job of providing them for these middle-income, middle-skill people. He says, I have to work with multiple headhunting firms to find the hourly labor to staff my factories. What? There's no reason for this.
Jeff, I want to just switch gears a little bit. Sure. One of the things that we heard a lot about is China. We owe all our money to China. Some people, you know, say the reason we're able to avoid Michael's issues of this fiscal cliff and this inability of Congress is that Europe is doing such a lousy job that for some reason people are still willing to buy our bonds at ridiculously low interest rates. That flow of global capital, that flow of money around the world, is that... What's going on with that?
I had some things to say about the previous discussion, but anyway, we can get back to them. But on this point, I think we lived through a very unusual decade. For the past 10 years or so, the world was largely divided in two big groups of countries. One big group of countries lived by consuming and borrowing in order to consume, and that would be the U.S., the U.K., and then so-called peripheral Europe, Spain and Greece, and then countries in Eastern and Central Europe and the former Soviet Union. And they borrowed their way into a big expansion of consumption and experienced very similar things to what we experienced in the U.S., a big increase in housing prices, a big increase in household debt or sometimes government debt, and they've also got themselves into the kind of debt crisis that we're in. The other big group of countries was countries whose engine of economic growth was exports. They were exporting principally manufactured products to the big consuming countries, and that would be China, Japan, Germany, Northern Europe more generally. And in a sort of ironic twist, they were lending their consumers the money to buy the goods that they were exporting. I think, and this was known at the time as the global macroeconomic imbalances, and I think there was a lot of fear starting in 2003-04 that they were not sustainable, and, you know, modern economics tells us that if something is not sustainable, it will probably come to an end. And it did. So I think what we face now is trying to figure out what a new pattern of international economic growth is going to look like. I would argue, and I think there is some consensus, that we are not going to go back to the previous period. We're not going to go back to a period in which China, Japan, Germany, other countries lend trillions of dollars to the big consumers, essentially as much as they want to borrow, so they can consume their exports. The willingness to lend to a lot of the European countries has disappeared. No one's lending to Greece these days, and that's not going to change anytime soon. The willingness to borrow on the part of a lot of countries, like the U.S. and the U.K., has also dissipated. And so we're not willing to take on the kinds of debts that we took on in the previous decade. So we need to find new patterns of economic growth. The flip side of this is that China and Germany and Japan need to find new ways of growing. China has, for over 30 years, with extraordinary success, turned its entire economy and its society and its political system towards producing manufactured goods to sell to the North American and European markets. And that string has played out. The appetite for Chinese imports has dramatically declined, and they have to find new ways of growing, largely depending on their domestic consumption possibilities. That's not easy. because reorienting an economy is not like turning a car around, even a driverless car. It involves political change and social change and economic change, and the Chinese are wrestling with how to turn their economy into a domestically consumer-oriented economy. There are many people who are very pessimistic about the prospects of this, and I think there are grave difficulties in the decade to come as this process works its way through.
Esther, I will ask people if they do want to ask questions, you can line up at the microphones. I'm going to ask a big favor: no political speeches. I've done this a few times, and we don't care what you think. We just want to hear your question. So.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah. No offense. Write a book. You'll get on there.
Wow.
So, Esther, this is just a thing I don't know how to think about, but I've spent a lot of time in Haiti since the earthquake. It's been an area of special focus for me. And there's nothing like spending a few weeks in Haiti to come back to America and think, there is no poor people in America. There is nobody who is living the way that billions of people are living. And to think that all the changes we're talking about, we should be dancing in the streets. The fact that the number of people in China and India and Bangladesh and Latin America have they have seen their lives improve so much because of this global trade. So what that the richest country in the world? I mean, I hate to say it, but a very poor person in America would be one of the richest people in Haiti. You bounce back and forth between these two worlds. How do you put those thoughts together?
Well, first of all, that's clear that my point of view is that we should consider the world as a whole, and therefore we should be worried about first the poorest person in the entire world, and then the second poorest, and then the third poorest. And that's why most of my work and most of my life is devoted to people who are really, really poor, who mainly live in other countries. There's one. So in that regard, when we are worried from here, looking from our perspective, we're worried about China. I'm like, good for them. Like, people in China live much better today than they lived 10 years ago, and in 10 years they'll live better than they live today, and that's a great thing. However, there are two caveats to that. The first one is that it's important to keep in mind the notion of relative poverty. I think poverty is both absolute, which is if you live under $1 a day, and you have to imagine $1 in Boston, trying to make a living for $1 a day in Boston, that's very, very little money to make a decent living on, and it means your quality of life will be different in absolutely radical way if you live in Haiti and if you live here, even if you're very poor. You'll be much more likely to die before your first month, and you'll be much likely to die before your first birthday, and you'll be skinny, and you won't be able to realize your potential as a human being, and so on and so forth. So absolute poverty is, of course, very important. Relative poverty also matters because we keep making individual comparisons. We keep thinking, how are the Jones doing? How am I doing? Am I on an upward trajectory? Am I on a downward trajectory? All of this concern about the middle class here is partly motivated by that, partly motivated by the fact that when people feel that they are just over for all of the growth that happened before the debt crisis, the vast majority of American people have been stagnating while the poor were going up. And the rich were becoming richer and richer, and that's not something that you like. And so when you're the poorest person in a rich country, and in particular if you see that you're going nowhere, there is an enormous amount of unhappiness that stems from that. And in particular because of this notion that it's partly your fault, that is reinforced by the 47% comments and things like that, you're even more unhappy. And so in total, maybe I think you have a much worse life if you're the poorest person, if you're a poor person in a village in Rajasthan, but at least you may have a sense that the future is with you and you're with the future. If the poorest person in a block in the Bronx, maybe you also feel that there is no future, and that makes a big difference. That's why, at the end of the day, the two notions have to be kept in parallel. That's why, even though most of my work and my life is devoted about the very poor people in the world, I also think it's very important to keep in mind what the globalization and the trade and technological progress to some extent is doing to the poor people here, and how we can keep that from creating this enormous amount of despair.
Can I just say, I mean, I think this, I agree with everything that Esther has said, but there's also a, if you will, a more pragmatic aspect to this, which is much of the political frustration that Michael evinces is due to the great polarization of income, in my view. Yeah. I think the experiences both of the boom and then of the crises are fundamentally different. If you're in the top third of the labor market, unemployment never got above 4%. If you're in the bottom third, it bottomed out at 18%. And if you add underemployment, it went up to 35%.
And I think engineers I saw was peaked at 2%, something like that.
Right, yeah. Right. So, but the top third, that's a large swath of society that could, with good reason, say, crisis is not so severe. Why should we be incurring trillions of dollars in debts to deal with the crisis that's not affecting us, especially since we know we're going to be paying the taxes to service that debt? So the economic polarization and the economic separation, I think, contributes to and feeds into the political polarization and gridlock that we experience. And I think that the two are very closely related.
Now, I think I might have overstated our lack of interest. Nobody's lining up. I mean, we do want to hear your questions. We just,
hear about
I
your
just
questions,
don't want
speech to
fine. That's all. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. This question is directed towards Michael and Andrew about high school's manufacturing training. So my question is, what are the capacities in the private sector? Are they there to retrain significant numbers of low-skilled people who are in the poor right now into high-skilled fields? And what's the outlook on that?
Well, I think it's certainly far from the surface in the political debate or in the media, but I think you're actually seeing now quite a revolution in the willingness of businesses to actually engage directly in the skills agenda. And that's for the reasons that we heard when we heard the Siemens case. We have this incredible mismatch. We have millions and millions of job openings and millions of people unemployed, but we can't make those match because the skills are wrong. Companies are now, we're seeing a sort of a renaissance of apprenticeship programs in the U.S. We're seeing all kinds of efforts to link up with community colleges and other schools to design sort of custom skill training in particular areas of need. We're seeing, I think one of the things we have to do is get the private sector to be deeply involved in this agenda, but the private sector then has to feel welcome in America. And it has to feel like the president respects the private sector. And we've had a horrendous debate about this. I mean, it's people in the private sector don't feel like, you know, our political leaders really are that interested, you know, in them. They think, oh, you guys have the money, you know, we just have to figure out how to get more of it from you. So I think that again, it all comes down to these problems can be solved. There are ways to collaborate and work through these areas. But you know, what we're now on is kind of a downward spiral. You know, the top 30% of Americans in terms of income are already paying almost all the taxes, already. And now we say, well, they have to pay more. Okay, I think most of them probably would. But what's happening is that because of the political polarization, we're not getting any of the legislation through that is necessary to provide the fundamental efficiency improvements and so forth in our economy to actually make things better and make this place more productive. So, and the more polarization happens, the more inequality happens, the less support there is for pro-business type policies, and so we just spiral and spiral and spiral. And at the end of the day, it's Hugo Chavez. That's where this ends up. It's populism. It's this idea that government will, some person like Hugo will say, oh, we can solve all your problems. We'll help. We'll take care of your whole life. And we don't want to get there, because what has he done to the whole Venezuelan economy? There is no more productive capacity in the Venezuelan economy. There's no business there anymore. So this is a moment where we could spiral further, or we could start to spiral back and start to see that we have a common interest. Upper-income people living in a country where lots of people have hopelessness and no opportunity to improve, that is a horrible
bad
thing for all of us, including upper-income people. And so we have to start to see that that in the ability to work through some of these fundamental issues, we all have to give some. We all have to be, you know, the people that are really uncomfortable with business have to understand that the corporate tax rate in America is too high. So people that hate business have to understand that unless we get the corporate tax rate down, we're not going to actually have enough investment to create jobs. But then the business people have to start understanding that in order to get to those good outcomes, they have to start not playing the lobbying game and the loopholes game. And we've got to start getting to be Americans again, and not low-income Americans, high-income Americans, business, non-business. We have to start becoming Americans again if we have any hope of addressing these issues, at least in my opinion.
So we have no hope of addressing them.
when problems in America somehow get to the level of being recognized, we have a wonderful historical track record of doing stuff in this country. You know, we're not like Japan. We don't have gridlock for decade after decade. Once we understand something and once we start to see the... So I think all of our jobs now is to elevate all of this to the point where we can start to be Americans again.
And to build on that just a touch, it's amazing to me when I talk to business people, people in government, people in academia, the playbook is really well understood and very broadly agreed on. I have to go really far to the left or really far to the right before I find someone who says, no, we don't need to invest in infrastructure, we don't need to change our educational system, we don't need to fix the debt crisis. There's this huge consensus, broadly anyway, on what needs to be done. I'm with Michael here. The galling part is the gridlock and the inability for us to actually make headway here.
And Esther, you wanted to say?
Yeah, just on the question of skills training, and one limitation that firms have for skill training is that if they invest in a skill that's very, very specific, then that skill might not be needed tomorrow because there'll be a machine that is being able to do that. On the other hand, if they invest in a skill that's a bit more general, then the worker won't be here tomorrow. Because if Siemens trained people who have some general skills, then whoever is going to take them and use them. So there is so the firms, although they are well placed to know what they need, are not ideally placed to provide to be at least the only provider of skills training, because they are in this like catch-22 solution. So this is fundamentally, this high skill training is really a public good, particularly as if you elaborate a bit on the work by my colleague David Otter. Mm. What's really hollowed out in terms of the demand is the demand for general skills that can easily be replaced by a computer. So someone who is flipping burgers at McDonald's, very difficult to do by a computer, so there'll be demand for
it's
that.
It's a bad job, but a safe job.
Being a lawyer, it's also hard to replace, at least being the boss of a law firm. On the other hand, being a law clerk is very easy to replace by a computer. So the type of skills that the economy needs now are skills for people who are eminently adaptable and will be able to keep changing as they'll be replaced either by more efficient Indian people or more efficient Chinese people or machines. And that is fundamentally a general skills problem, and therefore it will have to be provided by society, not only by the firms who need these people now. That means really we can't really save on thinking about what are colleges supposed to provide for skills? What are community colleges supposed to provide for skills? I don't have the answer to this question. I think nobody really does, to be honest. It's not that we know what to do and we are not doing it on this type of higher education skills. But again, this is something that maybe not enough thought is going on how to do it. And
All right. Thank you.
I'm curious about, this question is mostly for Jeffrey. I'm curious about your feelings of, do you prefer austerity to deal with the debt crisis, or do you prefer growth? And do you feel like austerity has a place, or is it caused too much damage, as we've seen maybe in Europe?
Yes. I think this goes back to the previous discussion. I think what's crucial to understand is that, as in so much else, timing is everything. And we've got a short-term problem, a medium-term problem, and a long-term problem. The short-term problem is to try to make sure that the recovery takes hold And that's over the next year, year and a half, whatever. I mean, the Fed has defined it in terms of leading up to 2015. Cutting spending, raising taxes will probably slow the recovery and are not a good idea in the short run. And this, I would translate this in slightly different terms into the European context as well, that the most important short-term concern is to get the economy growing at something approaching a normal rate. But then, if we look in the medium term, which we might define as 5 to 15 years down the road, we do have to address these looming fiscal crises or fiscal problems, and Americans have to get with the program. They have to understand that whatever the range of policies they want, social policies, national defense, you have to start paying for it. And that is associated with thinking about what we want from our Social Security system and our healthcare system and our Medicare system and things along those lines, and how we want taxes to be distributed or redistributed or reformed. So that's the medium. The long term, again, infrastructure and education. No one is going to disagree that two of the great weaknesses in the long run on a 20-year horizon in the U.S. are that we have a decayed and decaying infrastructure and a subpar educational system. And so I would divide the goals, which for some reason seems to be impossible to do in a presidential campaign, but divide these things into short, medium, and long range goals.
So do you think we could avoid austerity altogether by...
Well, it depends what you mean by austerity. I don't think we can avoid the need to increase the savings rate of American households. I don't think we can avoid the government starting to run something approaching budget balance. Right? I don't think we can avoid trying to make American firms more competitive. But those are medium to long-term goals, which are associated with, in my view, should be associated with more investment in things like education, infrastructure, overcoming the skills mismatch and things along those lines. I think we could have a much better tax system. We have a terrible tax system now, and it could raise more money and do so in a more equitable and more generally acceptable way. So it's not an either or. Yes, we do have to increase the savings rate. Yes, we do have to do something about the budget deficit, but that doesn't require Greece-style austerity. Greece doesn't require Greece-style austerity, but it certainly doesn't require Greece-style austerity.
We have 10 minutes. I do want everyone to have a chance for a quick closing statement. So I'm so sorry, everybody, but we'll have one more question, and then I'll have each of you sort of sum up your thoughts and based on what we've had. Can you get on the microphone, please?
Oh, sorry. This question is for Michael Porter, whose work informed my dissertation back in the 90s. I recently heard Andrew Slum, an economist at Northeastern University, speak, and he was talking about our unemployment problems in the society in which we have the biggest disparities in income that we have seen since the 1920s. And he said since 2008, we also have the most lopsided unemployment. 92%.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to get to the question.
Okay, yeah. 92% of the gains
okay, no more data, just the question.
Have gone to corporate profits, none to
all right, I'm going
to
call this speechifying, so let's go to the...
Income.
Okay, thank you so much. If you ask it right now with no data, and get on mic.
This is the first time
on
ever.
Mic.
Why has this happened?
I think that was what we just spent an hour and 15 minutes discussing. So I do want to get to final points. And I'm going to ask you each, and you're probably, I'm guessing, going to blow me off on this one, but is one of the candidates, do you see, or have you made a selection based on these issues, and do you think one of the candidates is a better at forming your position?
Are we off the record here, Adam?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Completely off the record. And I'm not going to answer the question. So, yeah. But you don't have to go there. I don't mean to embarrass you. I didn't warn you about that. But after hearing this hour, let's do 2 minutes each. You now, the president called you back, said, I talked to the rest of these guys. Give me two more minutes.
Do I go
first? Yeah, you go first. All right.
Well, again, I think almost everything that you just heard is part of this complex lattice of issues that we are caught in America right now. I think that, you know, let's not think that there's any easy solution, that if we just raise taxes on the upper income people, that will solve the problem. It just won't. It might delay it. It might mean that we can make the budget a little better, but ultimately, unless we build the productive capacity of our economy, unless we are able to have more of the people of working age in America actually working, unless that happens, then anything we do now in terms of raising taxes or even cutting spending is not going to matter. Ultimately, we have to become more competitive in the way I described. We have to become more competitive in the way where workers can benefit and businesses can compete. That's the fundamental problem, we believe. Now, there's we all have things that we think and things that we believe and emotions that we have about what's going on and who caused it and why it happened and who's to blame and who's the bad guy and who's the good guy. But boy, I think we got to park those for a while. You can have those kind of instincts when you're rich and things are going well, you know. But when you're in a position like we're in now, I think I'm just repeating something I said earlier. I think we have to be Americans now. And I think there's those business leaders that signed that statement, that I think that's a model for all of us. We ought to sign whatever statement we can sign, wherever we're coming from, like that. That we have to kind of come together and compromise and start to deal with the fundamental problems, the fundamental imbalances that we've allowed to create. That we, upper income people, we care a lot about the success of all of our citizens, not just some of them. And that lower income people understand that we need business, and we need high income people. They're not bad. Many of them are, you know, doing good things in our society. We have to become Americans. Historically, we've been good at that. That would be my summary of I think what is going to be necessary. And we'll just hope and pray that whoever gets elected will think that way, and will have the capacity to bring us together, and unfortunately for the last 4 years that hasn't happened, and who to blame I don't know, but it hasn't happened, and until it happens, until we deal with the high levels of consensus on what we need to do and actually do it, we're going to have a very polarizing situation in America for years to come.
Right, and Chavez 2016.
Chavez 2016.
All right. Andy?
We are heading into a science fiction economy and society, and we're heading there with a speed that continues to astonish me. One of my other hobbies now is to look around at jobs that I see being done and think, are we still going to need a person for that in a generation, in 20 years, given what I've observed about technological progress? And my answer throughout the day is no, 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 no. We're heading into a science fiction future. Some of us are probably sci-fi geeks in the room. We know there are two broad flavors of sci-fi future. There's a utopian one and a dystopian one. In my mind, the dystopian one is a very small elite who are masters of the machines and reaping the benefits from it, and a very large segment of people who are just left out in every important sense of the word. Terrible outcome. The utopian one is a little bit harder for me to visualize, but it's some kind of egalitarian digital Athens that's going on where people have material affluence and leisure and they're doing interesting things with their lives. It is not written which of those is going to happen, and it's a choice that we're going to face just in the next couple election cycles is going to put us on a path toward one of those or the other. It should be obvious that I prefer the utopian one.
So I'm taking that as Newt Gingrich is your man.
Jesus.
All right.
I want to be clear. Dystopian.
I'm not a Gingrichian.
All right. Esther?
You want an answer to your question?
If
you'd be the first.
Yeah. I'll give an answer. I became an American citizen less than a year ago. I'm going to vote for the first time.
Congratulations.
Until now, I've tried to stay aside of the political debate in France because I felt I'm not living in France, so I shouldn't really speak about France. And I've tried to stay aside of the political debate in the U.S. because I wasn't a citizen. So now I finally live where I'm a citizen, so I feel that I can have and express political opinions. Now, not be particularly surprising, obviously. I already explained that I have very, very, very Rawlsian view of the world, which is I care first about the poorest person in society, and then about the second poorest, and then about the third poorest. That doesn't mean, of course, that the rest of the economy doesn't need to be taken into account, because for the poorest people in society to do well, the rest of us need to do well. Business need to be able to operate. People need to want to live in the country, et cetera, et cetera. But when there are two candidates and there is one who explicitly says that he doesn't care about the poor, I guess that sort of rules him out. So I would clearly prefer for the president to be back in office. But then what I would hope is that there's much, much more seriousness the second time around, and ability, to be honest, about actually making better public policy, making better government policy. In the last 4 years, it's not that nothing has happened, but it's been really consumed in political fight, and I think more than we understand is happening under the radar screen. I think, to some extent, I hope that there are technocrats in Washington who are doing things stealthily, and in some sense, the food stamp example was one. Trying to make things better without making it a huge fight, but I think we could do much more on this front by being much more candid about what we do know and the vast amount of things we do not know about how to improve the effectiveness of public policy at various levels, from helping the poorest to building trains.
Jeff?
Well, I guess I should say that I'm disappointed but not surprised by the character of the discussion over the economy in the presidential campaign, and disappointed on both sides. I mean, from the president's side, I wish that the team had been more explicit and specific, both about their diagnosis of what the problems are and why we are in the difficulties we are in, and what specifically they would intend to do. That would have been useful and would have made me a little more pleased with the campaign, although it may not have been politically feasible. But when I look at the other side, what really disturbs me about the Romney-Ryan campaign is a number of things. First of all, an unwillingness or inability to take responsibility for 8 years of the Bush administrations, which really put us in the hole that we're now in. And that, I think, is very damaging to their credibility. Second, the fact that many of the proposals are not only unrealistic, we sort of expect that, but they are remarkably unrealistic. The numbers don't even come close to adding up, and especially the commitment or the alleged commitment never to raise taxes just doesn't square with any notion of how we're going to get out of the hole that we're in. The counter-argument, I suppose, which I have heard, and I take some think a little bit, is that when Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he was fairly reasonable and moved towards the center, and presumably as an individual he might be in that position, but it does worry me the thought of having a Republican House, Senate, and president, given what happened last time we had a Republican House, Senate, and president. So I think definitely that the country would be better off, and I would be happier if President Obama were reelected.
So fortunately, voting for Romney doesn't matter in Massachusetts, right. So we don't have to talk about that. We do have a Senate race.
There's Elizabeth Warren.
We have a Senate race. And that Senate race, there's a moderate in that Senate race. So I leave it at that.
Wow.
There's all a right. consensus.
Can we get another round, Adam?
Scott Brown is what he's hiring.
Ding.
I want to thank these guys so much. They're going to be signing books across the hall. Every one of them has books that are readable, substantive, intelligent. I don't normally, like I said, kiss butt that much. These are great, great thinkers who are also great writers. So please go across the street and thank them.
Adam,
so much.
Thank you. Right, thank you. Good stuff.
Did a great job.
Thank you.